Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 4th of May. And it's very nice. March. Wishful thinking on my part, I guess. March 4th. And it's very nice to have you all with us. And thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to us. It means a lot to us. And we thank you. We have a lot to talk about, obviously, and we have a wonderful group to do so, and we'll get started in just a moment. I want to remind you that you can be a part of the program. All you have to do is write to us at panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you, as always. Let me introduce the group to you, and we will get started. Malia Dumont is here, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Hello, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. We're happy to have you here, and thank you so much for being not only today, but for always being on our panel. Jay Jognowitz joins us, semi-retired, and here are all the things he does in his retirement. He is editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer at the Times Union. Jay, good morning. How are you?
I'm well, and you can add dance.
You dance?
Yeah, we start a new style of dance on Wednesday. We're going to be doing, I think, merengue. We just finished rumba.
Now, where do you do this at?
At the YMCA.
Oh, that's great.
In Gildan. Yeah, it's great. It's a one-month class every time. He does four classes, and we've gone through swing, we've gone through tango, cha-cha, salsa, which I really wanted to learn.
So in that hour, does it allow your mind to get away from what is happening in the outer world?
Completely.
So that's great.
Completely.
But I think we all need those activities.
Yeah, that and Tai Chi is the other thing I've been doing.
Nice.
So both of those, you just go away. Mm. It's really nice. And then when you're done, it's all back. And then people in the class find out what you do, and they're like, they want to talk to you about the world.
Share. Yeah.
Let's talk about this another time.
That makes sense. Former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain joins us. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I'm great. Happy to be here. And I'm glad to have such nice colleagues with me here today, including Jay, my longtime former colleague. Worked together with him for many, many years. And it's great to be with Malia. And I'm just happy to be here with you, Joe.
Well, thank you very much. We'll try to make some sense of the world this morning, and that's what our charge is, as it is every day. We welcome your input, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. All right.
We do our own sound effects here.
Sound effects. That's okay, so if you've been following the trials and tribulations of our relationship with Ukraine and the Ukraine president Volodymyr Zelensky, as well as the relationship between the between Russia and Russian president Vladimir Putin, the new wrinkle yesterday was that following the dust up, the showdown, the fight, the smackdown, the trap, whatever you want to call it, that happened on Friday, brought us to the point yesterday where the president announced that all U.S. aid would be paused. This comes days after the contentious meeting between Trump and Zelensky. The U.S. will pause all military aid to Kyiv until President Trump determines, he alone, that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is making a good faith effort toward peace negotiations with Russia, according to a White House official. I will say this. I think as far as what that punch list is of things that you have to accomplish to show good faith effort toward peace negotiations has not really been articulated, but we'll talk about that some. The president has been clear that he is focused on peace. We need our partners to be committed to that goal as well. We are pausing and reviewing our aid to ensure that it is contributing to a solution, a White House official said in a statement. The White House didn't announce under what conditions the U.S. would resume military aid, which drew from U.S. stockpiles, or whether it would be at the same pace. While there isn't a clear understanding of what Washington wants from Kyiv, the move was the most demonstrative shift yet from Ukraine's once top ally. A senior administration official said all of Trump's top national security advisors agreed with the decision to pause the aid after several meetings on the issue. In other words, who was going to disagree? All right. Let us, Malia, let us begin.
Well, as someone who works in higher education, where we get a lot of grants from the federal government, you know, I've been on the receiving end of several messages from the Trump administration over the past month announcing a pause in something, which later was summarily terminated or still a pause. But I think this is qualitatively different. Actually, in strange ways, I think Zelensky has more opportunity here to bargain with Trump than Americans who are working for the federal government who have, you know, had their work paused, or people like me who work at institutions who have had grants suspended or terminated. Trump is never going to close the door entirely on a deal. So the fact that this is paused clearly he's trying to retain what he feels is the upper hand in this relationship. It's a bully's way to negotiate. But I think there's an opportunity, and European leaders seem to be somewhat cognizant of this, even though Washington hasn't made clear exactly what they want. But I think based on Trump's behavior in general, one can expect that if people come to him cap in hand, or Europe demonstrates what he views as some kind of like expanded leadership or wanting to provide more aid to Ukraine, so it's not all on the United States. Again, I'm sort of, you know, expressing the Trump administration view on this. Then he'd probably be open to talking. So I don't think the door is entirely closed on U.S. support to Ukraine. This is Trump's way of opening an opportunity for further discussion.
So when you say that there remains hope that there can be a deal, is that a deal on the return of aid to Ukraine? Is that a mineral rights deal? Is that a peace deal? Is that a ceasefire deal?
That's a good question. I think Trump's very interested in the mineral rights deal, so that would be part of it. I think he would probably continue some amount of military aid. I'm not sure if the full pipeline that has been flowing will ever be restored. I think he wants to cut that off at some point, maybe not immediately, but he wants to continue eking this sort of conversation, this diplomatic engagement out to get as much as he feels like he can out of it. And getting what he can out of it is to keep reducing over time, keep reducing American aid, I don't think it's pretty clear. He doesn't really care what that means for the sovereignty of Ukraine or the well-being of the Ukrainian people.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, I think you're right, Malia. I think that the sovereignty and of Ukraine and the people of Ukraine are low on his list of priorities. I think what he really wants is what a lot of people want, and that is an end of this war. But the whole debate is about what, on what terms and in what way. He just wants it to end under his direction and with him being attached to it so he can claim the credit for it and then withdraw U.S. support for it and pretty much become isolated to it. The crisis there. He doesn't want, it's clear that issues like Putin's past performance, where he has not honored treaties, where he has broken promises, where he has invaded, in fact, Ukraine back in 2014 and again 3 years ago, that doesn't seem relevant to Trump's situation. It's sort of like reminds me of the British Prime Minister Chamberlain back in the 30s, where he met with Hitler and said, I just want peace at any price. And we know how that worked out. So it's populist to want to end that war, and to try to claim a role in that is something that he sorely wants. He wants to be show his power and his strength. You know, he wants the upper hand. He wants to be the broker. He wants to make the deal. It's transactional. It's like everything. It's no surprise. It's the behavior that he's exhibited since he was in public life.
I am not questioning you at all, Mike. I've heard this term used a billion times over the last week. Or since Friday, about, you know, he's transactional and he wants this, and this. And I get that. I understand. And of course, he is. But if you can't articulate what you want, like, isn't that a problem? Like, how transactional are you if you say, I want
you to grovel to me.
Yeah. I just think that, like, you know, he's very transactional, you know, and basically what the Friday meeting went down to is
optics, though. It's about optics.
He wants
it to look like he's brokering the deal. He wants to get the credit for, you know, ending the war in Ukraine.
Only said thank you twice. See, if he had just said it one more time.
Right. I mean, you, I don't know if it was you specifically, Jay, but the two of you had a good editorial on this, that Friday was a great day for Putin.
Yeah. For what?
For Putin.
For Putin.
Yeah. Well, absolutely.
Yeah. It was it was not my editorial, actually. Casey wrote that one over the weekend. As soon as it was happening, he just was like, you know, typing on his keyboard. It was like
bending.
Oh my God.
Yes.
I think you hit the nail on the head. He just wants to be able to claim a win. That's all that goes through his head at the moment, except for, and I'll get to the except for, giving. You know, people have asked if he was representing Russia in this negotiation, what more would anybody want? What more would Russia want him to be doing? I don't know. And you know, in addition to insulting him, which the Russian foreign minister, I think, posted a really insulting thing where he said, finally, the pig got his comeuppance or something like that.
And speaking about Zelensky.
It's just he is giving Russia everything. But more importantly, what we're seeing kind of offstage is he's also giving the relief on sanctions is imminent.
Right.
Without any concession, without any deal, the unilateral disarmament on cyber attacks that Hegseth has ordered, at a time when we are still being constantly assaulted by Russia, you know, from every direction through the internet, through all sorts of ways that happens nowadays. Trump is, you know, I the Russians have always been the chess masters in the world, in the literal world of chess and in the, unfortunately, in the world of diplomacy and foreign policy. And Trump is playing a game that is beyond, you know, go fish on the simplicity level. And what's frightening here is what all this, if you walk away from this with Russia suffering basically no consequences other than what it has lost in the war, and I don't think Putin particularly cares about all the human fodder that he has thrown at this and all the wealth that he's thrown at this, what is going to happen is a number of things. One is you are going to give Russia what Germany got back in the 1930s. It got constant advances. It mm-hmm. got constant pauses. It got more time to build up its military, to build up its strategy. And, you know, everybody figured the Maginot Line was where it would stop because it was so strong. And they ran over that in days, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert on warfare, but from what I remember, it was stunningly quick. And France has never really gotten over that humiliation. It also giving them relieving the sanctions in addition to giving them the power to rearm militarily and to regroup and retrench further ahead than they were before without being fired on, it also gives them money for soft power, which we are just surrendering all over the world with particularly with USAID and so forth. Russia's very, very good. You know, I'm reminded of a line. It's fiction, but in I think it was Homeland, where the KGB agent said, we are not aggressive. We look for problems that other people are having, and we help solve them. You're just a benevolent. You know, you're just benevolent overlords or benevolent do-gooders all around the world looking to come in and help countries. And that's what money will give them.
Lifting sanctions.
What? Yeah. Lifting sanctions. Yeah. And this is at a time, and I'll wrap it up. I have so much to talk about this, but this is what Trump, I don't know if he doesn't see it, and I don't know if he doesn't care, but this is what he's really giving them. And this is serious. This is scary.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. As Jay mentioned, there's so much to talk about and so many facets of this to discuss. We also will include your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll return right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are beginning the conversation, or we began the conversation, by talking about the news story that broke late yesterday, the U.S. pausing all military aid to Ukraine, according to the White House. This following the meeting on Friday between Presidents Trump and Zelensky in the Oval Office. We got this letter from John who says, "Oh, stop it. Nothing Zelensky did would have satisfied Trump and Vance. The Canadian European press have been calling Friday's meeting an ambush, and that was the point, to give Trump an excuse to cut off aid to Ukraine and hand Putin everything Putin wants." I don't know what we're supposed to stop, because I think we said exactly that, didn't we?
Mm. Well, we were just talking about that off the air. Was this planned or was it not? I tend to think that Trump had a tantrum. And everybody just had to go with it. But some of it did feel set up. The Vance comments about you didn't say thank you and so forth. What I always think of when Trump is going to, I'm sure in his State of the Union, is going to talk about what a brilliant, you know, deal maker he is, and how we're on the verge of a deal in Ukraine, thanks to my great work and my great negotiating skills. He reminds me of, and I've used this on the show before, I think, that little sticker my wife had at her store when she was running a shop, and it said, "Here's my brilliant idea, you work out the details." With Trump, it's, "Here's my crazy idea, you figure it out." And right-wing media figures it out for him, and the Heritage Foundation figures it out for him, and all the think tanks go, "Well, actually, if you look at it from a certain angle, it all makes sense, and it could be a brilliant strategy."
Here's what I don't understand, I don't know that it matters whether it was set up or not, but here's what I don't understand. Why do you have a press conference and start taking questions about how the negotiations went when they hadn't started yet? Like, normally you would have a meeting and then you would have a press conference. Instead of having a meeting with the press, not having the meeting, throwing the guy out of the White House, canceling the lunch, canceling the press conference. I just don't understand. Like, if you're going to bring the press in, you're going to ask some questions about the negotiations. And if you haven't had the negotiations yet, that just seems odd.
Well, to me, it's emblematic of Trump's unusual relationship with the press. He's not bringing them in for the usual...
Well,
they become
props, right? I mean, whether it be Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend or the Russian state media or whatever the case be, those are the props that are used, which would lead me to believe that, yes, then it would have been a setup.
I don't know if he planned to have a temper tantrum or not, but the end result is where he was headed anyway. And it may have just happened in slightly different way. I don't think he suddenly changed his mind because of his temper tantrum about what he wanted to do.
My sense is he wanted to be seen talking down to Zelensky and talking tough to Zelensky and
that's
wanted people to see
of
that.
Leadership.
Yeah, and that Zelensky had the gall to actually correct him on facts like Putin never honors these agreements, you know, which is fact. And this is coming after, you know, leading up to this meeting in the White House last week. I think Trump twice had called Zelensky a dictator and, you know, which is an outrageously incorrect and offensive way to describe someone who is, up until, I guess, now an ally. Anyway, he had the audacity to speak back and not just sit there quietly and be berated by Trump.
Him saying you have this, you have a beautiful ocean. Don't tell me what we have.
or the risks and the dangers and the influence. And I mean, he did act assertively, and that was probably what triggered. I think you're right, Malia. I think he wanted this all to be seen, and then when Zelensky triggered his tantrum, he starts going into all this stuff, you know, and the Russians, and we, you know, and he gets into that tirade about, you know, the Mueller report and everything. I mean,
I gave you the javelins.
Oh, man.
And Obama gave you sheets. Was that it? Yes.
Yeah. Sheets, yeah.
But what
we
got to talk about is what this means for the future of the Transatlantic Alliance.
Well, that's exactly. And I don't know, right?
Because the number one priority of NATO for the past few years has been supporting Ukraine. And so if the United States is no longer in favor of that, one has to wonder what is going to happen to NATO. And even within NATO, the strong multilateral and bilateral alliances that the United States has with certain key partners. I mean, a lot of our military operations are supported by the fact that we have important agreements, such as something called, you know, Four Eyes. It's the UK, Canada, Australia, obviously not NATO, but UK, Australia, Canada, and the United States have a really close relationship militarily. They have intelligence sharing. And I think UK and Canada, I know we're going to get to the Canada story in a bit, are going to start thinking twice about, do they want to continue? Do they feel like they can continue sharing intelligence with the United States? And these are some of the fundamental relationships that underpin these alliance structures.
You know, I think that Europe and NATO have an opportunity here. I don't know if I am not a diplomat. I don't know all the nuances of this, and the risks are high. But I think a couple of things are possible here. Trump has been just, you know, bully is the word. I mean, he's been bullying everybody. He's been threatening NATO. He's been dissing NATO. And there's an opportunity here, and I think the meeting this weekend may have been the start of it, for everybody to take Trump down a peg in the eyes of his own country. And that's what Trump doesn't want. He doesn't want to look bad in terms of his base and in terms of the United States. If Europe cuts a deal with Zelensky and says, hey, we'll make a mineral deal with you. You don't need the United States for this. We'll make a mineral deal. We'll create a fund. We will use that fund with the interest. I think it's the interest basically on Russian assets as well as the minerals to rebuild Ukraine in both militarily and infrastructurally. And if they say, you know, and we are going to start we will start building up our own military industries. I mean, they have signaled that they want the
United States.
But I think
Trump would count that as a win as well. You say, finally, Europe is taking control of their own security. We've been holding them up for all this time. We've been doing more than our fair share, and I've been the one who's been telling them they must invest more. And finally, they are, thanks to me. I think that's what he would say to
them. He could get that, but what he won't get, what he would lose out of that, is all the money that the United States gets from sales of military equipment. And we do have the toys.
Yeah.
We have the great toys. But if Europe says, look, we're going to start building better toys, they can
toys.
Do it. Yeah.
their defense industry can't really catch up to
They can
that
threaten
quickly.
Him in way, threaten him gently. It's not so gentle. But I think they can threaten him in ways that it looks like he really blew things up. And the first blow up he did was he was supposed to just walk away from that with a mineral deal. That's all it should have been. And he destroyed the whole thing. Now maybe he had other desires in terms of humiliating Zelensky, and he's performing for one person, it seems, these days, and that's Vladimir Putin. So he succeeded in that front.
But it seems that and you said this earlier on that early on that there were so many different so many facets to this, and it's hard to, but just in the mineral deal, I mean, that was a shakedown.
Mm-hmm.
You shook the guy down and said, basically, I'll give you the mineral deal if we can, Zelensky saying, we'll give you the mineral deal if we can sit down and have a negotiation and have some security promises here as a result. So to blow that up in the first, 10 minutes, just, okay, well, then what are we doing? And that was never really clear to me.
But going back to what you asked earlier, Malia, what does it mean for the, a transatlantic alliance? This is potentially a major shift that goes back 80 years, in what goes back 80 years post-World War II. And does the U.S. no longer want to be primary allies with the Western powers? I mean, this is as if we're saying, yes, we no longer want to be that. We just want to be one of the power brokers in the world, along with Russia and China and just kind of divide it all up. And that's a scary, frightening, thought. And the idea that he was berating Zelensky about, you're facing, you could lead to World War III. This is exactly what could lead to World War III. It's this fragmentation that has an alliance that has kept any member of NATO, or any European country that's in NATO, or any country in NATO that has kept them without any invasion, kept all of it at peace. It's been tough. NATO hasn't been perfect, but boy, it has had enormous success in maintaining a balance in Europe and security in Europe.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, and we'll continue with your letters. We have many. We'll get to those. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Music from Alison Brown this morning, and you can find out more by going to the playlist, which is available on our website, panel@wamc.org/roundtable. That's what it is. panel@wamc.org is where you can write to us and share your thoughts on what we're talking about today. We have many people who have done just that, so let's go to them. We begin with Mary. An important part of U.S. aid to Ukraine was use and sharing of military and strategic intelligence to aid the fighters on the ground. Now that intelligence, quote-unquote, agencies are headed by pro-Russia sycophants like Tulsi Gabbard, is that really a useful tool anymore?
To be honest, I don't know what kind of intelligence we were sharing with Ukraine, and I assume that that falls under this larger rubric of all aid being paused.
We then go to... this is a really good letter, but I'm going to hold it just for a second. Kathy says, being the narcissist that he is trying so hard to be considered for the Nobel Peace Prize if he gets peace between Ukraine and Russia. He does not like that President Obama had gotten that prize. I'm sure that's an element, but not the
does
main
it mean
motivation.
That they take it away from Obama to give it to Trump if Trump gets the Nobel Peace Prize?
It's an annual
thing.
Wonder. It's like you don't lose an Oscar when George Clooney gets one,
I wasn't sure.
You keep it. You just have to show your birth certificate again.
It does go. So no, I love this. The writer brought it up because, you know, I was just thinking of all the grown-ups in the room who have, you know, I think back to when Angela Merkel allegedly called Barack Obama, said she had just gotten off the phone with Vladimir Putin and said, he's crazy. And she was scared. She was worried about what the implications were for Europe and for world peace. And this was, I think, right around the time of the Crimea invasion. And we have had people like Barack Obama. We've had people like, for all his faults, George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. We've had Bill Clinton. We've had George H.W. Bush. I don't know where to put him on the thing. And now we've got this child in the room who's just unpredictable, who's can't use that word, messing on everybody and messing up the whole balance of things and the NATO. You know, what has kept us stable for so long in a very, I think we take for granted that stability, how tenuous it was.
And I don't think it's, I think it's a direct result of that this sudden invitation was extended by King Charles to Trump over the weekend to come do a state visit to the UK. It's very early in the presidency for them to extend such an invitation. I don't think they were planning to do so quite so quickly, but but you know, the UK has long been the US's closest military ally, and so they need to sit down with him. Like, you know, what is going on?
Yeah. And it's not the prime minister, it's the king, which has got to really stroke Trump's ego.
Florian writes to us and says, nothing in the Oval Office in front of the cameras is not staged. So, yes, it was a setup. We go to Tricia. But wait, can Trump just pause or cancel the funds to Ukraine by himself?
Good question. I mean, in 1974, Nixon was taken to court and lost at the Supreme Court for impounding funds. And that seemed to establish that it's Congress's, under the Constitution, it's Congress's role to spend money, and it's the president's role to oversee that, but make sure that it's carried out. And that was the result of the Nixon lawsuit that he lost back in 1974. But it seems like courts are not stepping up. It can't happen fast enough. Congress, the Republican leadership in the Senate, who could step in and have some influence, certainly not the House. The Republicans in the House are all there, and they're just sitting back and basically doing nothing.
They need a delegation, not just one person, like the Speaker or the Majority Leader going over and calling him up on the phone and saying, "Hey, Donald, it's kind of a problem here." They need a delegation
that will not
of people
happen.
To go over. And
These
say,
people have lost that ability to do that. And now is if they tried to even privately go against Trump, he would sic Elon Musk's money on their next primary opponent, and they know that, and they'll lose.
Because you would need like six or seven spines, right? I mean,
a couple have sort of complained about it.
You'd need the factions.
That's a partial
together.
Spine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you need a good
spinelet.
A spinelet, right. Right. Susan Collins maybe exhibited a little bit of spine.
Murkowski was outspoken on it, but I think we've seen that story
enough.
Before. Right.
Yeah, and those are women. They're not going to have that much influence over the Trump.
Sheila writes, dear panel, you folks are falling all over yourselves trying to figure out Trump's intentions. He is simply using a strongman tactic to delay any talks about peace on Putin's behalf. I still believe that Putin has something on Trump, which is why he cannot bring himself to say anything that would upset the apple cart.
It's all about Hunter Biden's laptop, okay? That's just really what we're talking about here.
I do think, it was a lingering thought from the Friday, whether it was staged or not. I do think that Trump, who if there's nothing he doesn't think about 24 hours a day, it's his image and what is going to be the next thing that gets the limelight on him.
I think that he was stinging from the Macron visit.
Really?
Having Macron put his arm on his arm, which is a power move that, I mean, that's one of Trump's power moves. Having him put a hand on his arm and saying, excuse me, I'd like to correct you on something. It was brutal, you know, by Trump standards. And I think he was stewing over how bad that looked and how mocked he was for it and how praised Macron was for it. And I think he had to get back at somebody. And Zelensky,
it's an easy one to get back at Zelensky.
We're getting a lot of letters on this as far as, you know, whether it was staged or not. But for me, I mean, sort of the tell at the end is, well, that was good television.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, him saying, well, exactly. that was good television.
I know one thing.
He's not
that
afraid
was
of,
good television.
Wasn't
of
that losing great? Control like that because he knows it's – like, that's why he invites the press in. He likes being sort of unpredictable and unhinged.
Yeah.
It's all about the entertainment factor while being a strong man.
Well, if Angela Merkel was there today, she'd probably call, the Prime Minister of the UK and say, he's crazy. I'm talking about Trump. And maybe that is the upper hand. They don't know what he's going to do. They're frightened about what he's going to do, and he maintains power by that. It's a bully tactic.
That's what the Trump people on my feed, what are left of them, because I had to block a lot of them. They were just getting abusive. But that's what they say. This is a negotiation. It's brilliant.
Teresa says Trump wants whatever Putin wants, period. Ukraine be damned. The comparison to Chamberlain is silly. Then Russ says, unfortunately, joint procurement agreements for NATO have reserved the manufacture of cutting-edge air defense munitions to the United States, leaving Europe unable to effectively make up the difference resulting from the U.S. arms embargo in Ukraine. There will also be a problem in obtaining 155-millimeter shells. Trump is essentially participating in Putin's extortionate attack on Ukraine cities, including cities not on the front lines. Then, here was a letter I was saving because it's long and I thought it would be good for conversation because it does bring us in a somewhat different direction. But Levi writes, can you explain to me where the Democrats are at the moment? The Democrats absolutely need to start stepping it up. Enough intelligent recapping of what Trump's doing. People need to start directing people on what needs to happen to remove this madman from power. Democrats and all reasonable people need to start getting unconventional. Honestly, at a very minimum, the Democrats should be doing everything in their power to convince a few patriotic Republicans to switch parties so they can make history and remove this threat. I don't care if they think it's impossible. They need to show the country just how serious the threat is. Time to start acting unconventionally. Enough with the predictability. Everyone needs to pause on the never-ending Trump reflections and start suggesting concrete plans of actions. Hey, do you all have any ideas? Well, I mean, I think this comes in somewhat as a result of the James Carville commentary of it's good just to play dead. Meaning just watch the destruction from afar. Bernie Sanders, I thought, had an excellent point who said, I believe that the Democrats have been playing dead for the last 12 years. So it's an interesting point as to what the Democratic Party does in this case. We were joking about Murkowski. We were joking about Collins. But certainly very few Democrats have gotten in the face of anyone in the administration to defend.
So it'd be really interesting to see what Alyssa Slotkin says tonight. She's been selected. She's the newest senator from Michigan. I worked with her 10 years ago. We were both in the Pentagon together in the Office of the Secretary. I don't know her really well, but, you know, I've sort of followed her career. And she's been in Congress in Michigan. And she was recently elected senator. And as one of the rising stars of the Democratic Party, she was selected to deliver the response. As a centrist Democrat in the Midwest who has a strong national security background, I think she's prepared. She has, I don't know if she has 6 or 7 spines, but she's got 4 or 5 of them. So I'll be very interested to see what she says in response to whatever he proclaims. tonight. But I think the letter writer makes an interesting point that about that Democrats are, like, at least in Congress, in some sense seem to be, you know, they're not trying to flip Republicans, at least not openly, because they probably think it's a losing cause. But this listener writes in and says, well, even if you think it's impossible, you should at least be trying and be out there and be, you know, talking about it. And that's something we're not really seeing.
I mean, are there any potential, you know, Murkowski and Collins and maybe Mitch McConnell now that he's in his you know, twilight years, and he evidently hates Trump. You know, maybe there's three potential John McCain type people there. But is there anybody with a spine like John McCain had back in 2017?
I honestly don't know. But like, if you think you're in emergency situation, like end times for American democracy, then you should try everything and open every door, mm-hmm. even if you think there's going to be a brick wall on the other side of it. I think that's what this listener is suggesting.
Right, and then the Democrats need to speak up. I mean, I was struck by the New York Times piece on Chris Murphy a week or so ago.
Yeah.
About him coming
What's
out.
Happened since then with Chris Murphy?
Well, right, and then he shut up, right?
I
mean,
know.
He was all over the place talking, and then that article came out, and then he stopped talking.
Yeah.
So I assume he hasn't, but it hasn't been as apparent as I thought it would be following that.
You know, there was an interesting story. I think it was either the Times or the Washington Post about how I think it was called the fairness gap or the voter gap or something. So it was the idea that when redistricting and gerrymandering were at their
yeah.
height,
yeah,
there was a real imbalance. Essentially, we
Why are
had,
you speaking in the past tense? Mm.
Well,
it was
well,
saying
that's
it's still here.
It's still here, but some things have leveled out. And the way they measure that is how many votes people get in Congress versus how many it's the imbalance between how many people voted for the people in Congress versus how many voters there were. And when that starts to level out, what you end up with is apparently a more representative Congress. In other words, you're accurately represented. You're not unfairly represented. It means the Republicans aren't winning with small pluralities when you look at the total vote. The way that connects to what we're talking about, possibly, I don't know. I am not an expert on this stuff, is that the question of who's got the spine and who's got the districts that they think they might survive in. Because I don't think you're going to find too many Liz Cheneys out there who are going to say, I don't care what my political future
no,
is.
No, you're not going to. There is not anybody who really is a profile in courage the way Liz Cheney was, who's ready to risk it. These are Republicans who are rationalizing their silence right now by saying, if I speak out now, they'll primary me, and then my constituents won't have my brilliant representation. They'll have some right-wing wacko instead of me. So it's really better for me to be quiet now so that I can stay in my office and represent them much better than the crazy that they'll get instead of me. This is the rationale. I mean, it's despicable, but it's the rationale.
We are painfully late for a break. We will do that right now. We'll be back right after this. Good morning and welcome to the roundtable. Welcome back and to our panel discussion this morning. Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia DeMontis here. Semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer at the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and former Times Union Associate Editor, Mike Spain, all with us this morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. And we will move on to other stories this morning and talk about other stuff. So, tariffs being the other order of the day, the Dow is currently down 610. That was somewhat to be expected as a result of these tariffs beginning today. Tariffs for Mexico and Canada. Trump said in remarks Monday that he planned to proceed with 25% tariffs for Mexico and Canada. And yes, markets are falling as a result of that news. President Trump said tariffs on goods from Mexico and Canada would go into effect, ending a month-long delay that saw both U.S. neighbors scramble unsuccessfully to head off the punishing trade action and sending stock prices into a swift decline. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down around 1.5% Monday. Imposing tariffs on everything Americans buy from Mexico and Canada is an extraordinarily political gamble by a president who was returned to power by voters angered over years of high inflation, higher prices in general. The new import taxes are likely to raise the market prices of things like Mexican tequila and beer and avocados, along with Canadian crude oil and lumber, testing consumer patience with the Trump approach. Tariffs on China will also increase by an additional 10 percentage points for the second time in 2 months, bringing the total tax on some Chinese products to 45%. The Trump announcement stemmed from his complaints about cross-border flows of undocumented migrants and drugs, notably fentanyl. But at the same time, the president has a broader goal to encourage manufacturers to return to the United States after liberalized trade and outsourcing since the mid-1990s contributed to the loss of 4.5 million manufacturing jobs. Jay.
Well, I think he had to do this in the sense that he needs to look strong. You know, the pause kind of made it look like, you threatened this for months, you know, even when he was on the campaign trail, and then he didn't do it. And I think he needed to look like he is not he's not bluffing on this stuff. So, you know, that's all. I think that's just all part of the Trump persona. But global markets are down. They were already starting down yesterday. And I think this happens overnight. So I think that they're already happening. By the time he takes the stage at the State of the Union, we're going to be very clear as, you know, what's happening with the American markets at the end of this day. And this is this day and tomorrow and probably, you know, through the end of the week are really going to tell just how bad a hit this is. You know, and at the same time, tonight he is, he's going to be promising. It is tonight, right?
Yes. Yeah. Tonight at 9 o'clock, right. Which you can listen to right here on WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, 91.3 on your
cued you right up, didn't
it? Or online at WAMC.org.
He will probably say, you know, make all sorts of predictions about how this is going to bring home manufacturing. We're going to have cars made in America again. We're going to have this made in America again. We'll have avocados grown in America again. You know, it's all going to be a prediction game up until it's not. And, you know, I think the hope for the Democrats have and the hope that anybody who thinks that Trump is unfit for office have is that this is going to be painful for Americans. And then Americans are going to wake up and say, OK, I'm going to call my congressman or I'm going to tell them at a town meeting, this has got to stop. You got to start doing something to rein this guy in. That's the hope.
Malia.
You can't magically undo globalization with some tariffs. That's a basic economic truth. Yeah. And, globalization hasn't been good for many American workers. That's true. A lot of them have suffered. But they're going to suffer more under these tariffs. I had a long conversation last night with one of my best friends who's a tech entrepreneur in Toronto. And correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, but I believe the listening area for this radio station actually stretches all the way up into southern Quebec. So we have some Canadian listeners,
into Canada, almost up to Montreal.
Yeah.
Wow.
So hello to all our Canadian listeners. And I hope they're impressed that I learned my lesson from my friend in Toronto that that's the correct way to pronounce it, not Toronto. We are Canada friendly here.
I've been watching the Murdoch Mysteries, so that's all I got right now.
Okay. But they are.
You're a friend in Toronto.
Yeah, well, he went to college in the United States. He spent a lot of his adult life in the United States. He considers himself, you know, pro-American, but he's been back in Canada this past several years. And he described an environment of bewilderment and anger and fear that Canadians at first.
Welcome to the club.
I know, yeah. Welcome to the club. And he was surprised. Like he was, you know, I just called him to see how he was doing, and then he just went off. He's clearly waiting to talk to somebody about this.
I called.
So when Trump first started talking about making Canada the 51st state, people sort of, you know, kind of thought it was in bad taste at best, or laughed it off as a bad joke. He said nobody's taking it as a joke anymore. They see Trump. A lot of Canadians are worried that Trump is like Putin light, and he intends to do to Canada what Putin did to Ukraine. And he said, he, you know, it hadn't occurred to me that Canadians would be afraid of a U.S. military invasion, but he's thought about it. He said, you know, as a member of the U.S. military myself, I have worked side by side with Canadian military officers. They're terrific, but you know, they don't have, you know, near the numbers that the U.S. No. military. So they're really, they view the one phrase he said to me over and over again is, we view, and he's, you know, speaking on behalf of his fellow Canadians, we view this as an act of war. This how could you do this to your closest trading partner? Mm-hmm. You know, what have we done? Like this trumped up. I didn't mean that as a pun,
no.
but
accusation
that, you know, a lot of fentanyl is coming across right. the border. Like that isn't really happening to the extent that the president is saying it is. You know, the Canadians haven't always benefited from the trade relationship as much as the United States has. So why is the United States punishing Canada in a way that actually punishes our own people? He's just said that they're at a complete loss.
Yeah, it appears to be exactly what your friend was saying, that we're like poking them in the eye, and then when they react, we'll say, there, oh, you know, they're our enemy all of a sudden, you know. It's like you can bully somebody until they react, and then you look at them and say, I guess they're not our friend anymore, our ally anymore. And it is so heartbreaking because, you know, when you think about World War II, when you tour Normandy, you know, you see the beaches where the U.S. landed and where the U.K. landed and where Canada landed. And, you know, we went there together as allies, and they have been our ally all along, and they have been our friend all along. I just can't understand it. And then to go after Mexico, and what Trump is really undoing is the trade agreement, the USMCA, I think it was, that he brokered when he was president for his first term. He's destroying that. He was bragging about how wonderful it was for us and our allies, and now he's just, you know, crushing that, and it is puzzling, and I am very interested to hear how Canadians are interpreting it. And we you know, they boo the American hockey team. You know, they're not buying American products now. They're boycotting American products. It's a completely unnecessary situation. Completely unnecessary.
And undoing deals, essentially, like a USMCA. I had forgotten all about this, about the fact that Ukraine had one of the world's largest nuclear stockpiles at the end of the Soviet Union, and it agreed to give those up in exchange for assurances that Russia would never invade, and that we, the United States, NATO, they weren't a member of NATO, but we would protect their territorial integrity. That's gone out the window, and when deals that people sign are no longer respected and no longer valid, and they're just thrown out on a whim by, you know, one dictator or one American president in pursuit of being a dictator. The whole thing is upended. I lived on the Canadian border in Ogdensburg, and then a little further away from the border in Watertown for about 5 years when my first daily newspaper jobs. It was delightful. You'd go over to Canada, and it was just like you were just visiting, you know, cool people. It was a nice place. New York, northern New York, as you know, is pretty poor. Southern Canada is their is kind of their Gold Coast. So you just had a wonderful time, and it was sort of European, but it wasn't. It was sort of American. It was sort of European. They came over here. There were Russian military officers in the United States Army. I did not know that, but I made friends with one who used to go back and forth to Ogdensburg to buy shoes because we had good shoes and cheap chickens. All this is just being thrown out the window. It's just so weird. For what?
Well, that's the question. For what? I mean, what's the end game? And that's what we don't. And how do we know?
How do we know when we're winning?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, my version of that was, I mean, how do we know when this is, when we've reached the end goal of whatever that is? I don't know.
You know, yeah. It's where we have them on their knees. And, you know, we're talking about Canada. It's a border. The New York State borders Canada. But, you know, this is going to have very, very horrible impact on the Mexican economy. I mean, it's really going to hurt Mexico in many ways. And, you know, they're going to retaliate with some trade, replies, I guess, today. But it's going to hurt people. It's going to make people angry. It's going to make people angry at the United States. It's going to destroy decades of wonderful, warm goodwill unnecessarily. Yeah. Why? To what goal?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, and the damage it's doing, I think there was I was listening to the story on this station on the way in about how it's also upending Canadian politics, where the Conservatives look like a lock,
right?
And now they don't because they're seen as being too close to Trump, to Trump light or Maple MAGA, I think was the term. It's a great term,
Maple MAGA.
But to your question, Joe, I think it's the fundamental question: how do we know, you know, when we've achieved our goals? And the fact that we're asking that question, that we don't know what the end game is, I think is a sign that on the spectrum between, you know, democracy and dictatorship, we have moved a little bit farther towards, you know, away from democracy. Because in a democracy, the interests of the people are clear and the leaders represent those interests. And there's a certain level of transparency that the citizenry can expect. Now, there are always, you know, secrets. That's why we have an intelligence community. But the basic interests of the people of the nation are generally understood and are represented in an open and transparent way. And that's not what we have right now. That's partly why we're all so confused, is there's such a cognitive dissonance. Like, you know, we're in this democratic system and yet we don't know what's going on. Well, it's because the system is less democratic than it's supposed to be.
This is, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but this is another issue that has come up that was not fully articulated during the campaign, right? I mean, this is yet another thing that
yeah,
was,
it's like the
out.
Whole Elon Musk, you know,
Doge,
fire everybody,
like,
thing.
We didn't hear about Doge until
after the election. Yeah.
And and tariffs coming up, especially. While I think there was a broad conversation about tariffs, but I don't believe Mexico and Canada ever mentioned within that in the campaign. I just, meaning that whatever the agenda was, that it you know, these are all the things I'm going to do on day one, and the things that were actually done on day one or day 30. Vary from that quite a bit, including this, which again brings me to Malia, to the point we were talking about of, you know, and something like this, it just seems very.
What's the goal?
Yeah, like it seems very hair trigger, and you don't know, it's not planned out, and you just say we're going to do it, and it should be 10%. I'll make it 25%, but 10% last week. We'll do it again. We'll have more, and now it'll be 25%. And what is it? China 45%.
It's about his mood of the day and his personal opinion, which is not how the presidency is supposed to function.
And that, I think, is again leading to this of us all, many of us, and people who, I mean, whether they supported the president or not, to say, okay, so what are we doing? And what is the, especially, and I think, I forget who made the excellent point of we'll see tonight, we'll see, Jay, over the next couple of days, you know, see what the market brings us of where it is by the end of the week and what the impact is on this.
And we're going to, you know, if the market isn't good, we will hear, well, the market isn't the economy. And if the market is good, it'll be, look at the great market, look at the great stock market that I'm that I've done. It's not going to be good by the end of the week unless something dramatic
happens. I mean,
there'll
be some buybacks. Some people will figure out how to make money off of it. You know, the market really is just a bunch of, you know, it's the uncertainty of everything that is the most troubling to the
unless it's global. And then you start to have an economic crisis.
Right. And that's the other thing, sorry, that my friend in Toronto said last night. I mean, he's a tech entrepreneur who's working on a big project to digitize health records. And the biggest markets he wants to be in are in the United States. And he says, we can't plan right now. So this is something that would help.
Yeah. I mean, what if you ran a business in the U.S. and you were going to expand or you were going to buy materials or you were going to hire or something? Everything is going to be on hold. This is going to ripple through the economy. The Federal Reserve came out yesterday and said that they, instead of seeing a 2.9 growth potential for the next year, they're looking at a 2.8% drop in the, you know, economy next year. And now Trump wants to change the way they compute that number that doesn't make it look so bad.
But, you know, like I had this terrible thought when I saw that same thing and that, you know, the amount of cuts that are being made, whether, you know, we know that a lot of the statistics that Doge is posting are incorrect, but still, it's a huge amount of cuts, no matter how you slice it. And let's say enough cuts are made that Trump can send a $5,000 check to most American taxpayers with his name on it. You know, even if the tariffs cause American taxpayers to have $6,000 more in expenditures throughout the year, you know, that it's harder to add that up than it is to see this $5,000 check in your hand with President Trump's name on it. And so, like, he's going to be able to argue in ways that that don't make sense, but that will appeal to people's emotions. And it's harder to draw all the connections between the negative effects of what he's doing and then him just standing up saying, I'm being a leader. Like, that still a lot of his supporters, that's still what they see this as a sign of leadership. But Alyssa Slotkin, it's not that just that she's a, you know, a young rising star senator. She represents the great state of Michigan, which is going to be one of the most affected areas from these tariffs with Canada, because a lot of the car manufacturing, it's headquartered in Michigan, but it is a true cross-border operation. I mean, pieces
Canada
move
and
back
Mexico.
And forth, across the border on a daily basis. You know, some parts come from here, they go back across the border, you know, multiple times before a car is created. And but in the meantime, we haven't even mentioned China. Speaking of cars, you know, while we're arguing about all of this, they've cornered the market on electric vehicles, and they're
flooding the world with them.
Yeah.
All right. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to I'm trying to – I just got an email, and I'm trying to figure it out. Okay. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with the program and finish up our time together with our wonderful panel. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Mike Spain, Malia Dumont, and Jay Jochnowitz all with us. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. And we'll get to a few of those. We have some on this topic, and we'll move on, try to get one more topic in before the bottom of the hour break. We'll hold now and then come back after this break and news from the BBC. Oh, Okay, 15 minutes left, and two topics I'd like to get to in that period of time with our wonderful panel. Malia DeMond, Jay Jochnowitz, and Mike Spain with us, and, of course, your letters panel at WAMC.org. Real quick, we've been talking around it and addressing it a bit, but does anyone have thoughts on what the speech will contain tonight as we look in the speech to Congress, which, interestingly, is not called the State of the Union when it is the first year. Yeah. For a president just coming into office, even for a second term in this case, but a joint address to both houses of Congress, and he is expected to boast about DOGE cuts as well as his work in and on Ukraine.
And what we'll see is the, you know, the deceit about DOGE, about how much it's saved. We were talking about this on the break. It is going to be to say there's going to be exaggerations is to say that Trump is giving an address tonight. I think it was on the air. We were talking about the $5,000 checks.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I suspect he's going to bring that up. And that is... that is a hard thing to say no to. We were having this discussion on the editorial board when Hochul proposed the $500 checks or announced the $500 checks that she wants to give New Yorkers. And I was the Debbie Downer in the room saying, you know, it's all well and good, but does the governor really need to give away money? Or maybe could we use this for something that government actually needs to do as opposed to just making voters happy? But, you know, how do you say that? $5,000. We are now understanding that all the money, and this was a choice that the government made, and this was a forced error, if you want, or it was a way to save the economy. During COVID, the government flooded both under Trump and under Biden, the government flooded the economy with money, printed money, and gave it away to Americans. And surprise, surprise, we ended up with inflation. And that was only, I think, $2,500 when you added it all up, maybe $3,000 when you added it all up. You start giving everyone $5,000 now.
Well, inflation.
Before inflation has even cooled off. It has started to cool. And maybe you could say
a good recession will end the inflation.
Well, yeah. It would, yeah. But not if you throw another $5,000 per family or per person or per taxpayer into the thing. So anyway— you're going to hear, I think, a lot of feel-good stuff, a lot of populist stuff, and it's going to fall on the Democrats to try to explain this in a way that America, A, doesn't fall asleep and feels like, and doesn't feel like, oh, come on, I want my $5,000.
So, interestingly, when I heard the president talk about the $5,000 for the first time, I think he said, And DOGE is saving us so much money, we could end up with $5,000 checks. Mm-hmm. But we'll see what happens. Okay, well, we'll see what happens immediately told me, probably not, right? But I here again, this is one of these things where that would have to go through Congress. And given what Congress is doing with the budget as a whole right now, I understand.
It'll be Congress's fault if we don't get our $5,000 check, Joe.
Right.
It won't be the president's
fault.
Well,
that's it. And it just seems to be a setup, I guess, in the sense of, where do we go from here? But I understand it's a good talking point, but if it's not based in any real reality.
One would hope, but as you said, you know, is Congress going to stand up and say, now's not the time to be giving everyone $5,000 and we're not going to get a balanced budget out of that and we're already borrowing $2 trillion more or $3 trillion or $10 trillion, whatever it is. Yeah. They may have to say.
But we
no.
saved the money.
We saved the money.
Musk had that chainsaw out and all going into the departments and all that money with the chainsaw hitting everything. All
That's
that stuff
true.
Is falling down and the money's just raining down on us.
Well, that is the image that, you know, all kidding aside, that is exactly what they want to portray. And that becomes the justification not only for a tax rebate or whatever they want to call that. It's the continuation of the tax cuts from 2017, which will cost us another $4 trillion in debt. And it will go in large part to people who don't need it whatsoever. And some people will get a little relief from it, but the people at the lower end really won't see much. So the $5,000 might, dangling a $5,000 check might be a way to, you know.
I am 57 years old. I have never turned on a chainsaw in my life. And not only that, I don't believe I should be turning on a chainsaw because I will hurt myself or someone else. And I know that. So I know I will never be a billionaire because I could not do that with any positive outcome that it was going to be good. I just assume that me or someone that I love is going to end up ruined as a result of my using a chainsaw. I don't know. It just seems like that is a sort of a, you know, it's you talked about the image of it. I mean, but it is a rather like a violent image of what we're doing to our government, what we're doing to our government spending. And again, without a real plan, without an idea of what is coming out of that, 5,000 jobs here, 3,000 jobs there, 800 jobs here, 87% cuts there. But so who's doing the work? What's going to happen? And how does that all end up making sense to the American people?
Well, I'm sorry.
I don't think we're going to hear any kind of justification or answer to any of those questions.
No.
I think President Trump is most comfortable when he's on the attack. And so the question I have in my head is, who's he going to attack tonight? Well, he's probably going to continue to attack Zelensky and Democrats in general. But, you know, what else haven't we heard about recently? Well, it turns out that yesterday the new Secretary of Education was just approved.
Linda McMahon.
So I imagine he's going to want to, you know, tout that, his great success in bringing her in and what's going to happen with DOE.
Congratulations. You are now in charge of a department that we are going to close down.
Right.
Or they're going to use it only as a skeleton, as a bully pulpit over all of American education. Like that's sort of seeing so far.
Scary.
You know, we haven't heard much about Kash Patel yet, but I can't imagine that Trump isn't going to use this opportunity. It's his first time talking, you know, to joint Congress since he's taken the presidency about, you know, these witch hunts against him and what, you know, what the FBI and Department of Justice are going to do. I mean, I think he's going to. The full spectrum of issues that occupy his mind, he's going to be on the sort of attack and very aggressive on all of those. And so, you know, we're focusing on Ukraine today and on these tariffs. But let's not forget there's all these other parts of government that he's setting up to either be downsized or to be used in ways that haven't been seen in a long time, if ever. So I think part of his intentions with those are going to become a little bit more clear tonight.
Well, I think what we're witnessing and what we'll witness tonight is a revenge presidency. And that's really what's going on. And he's taking his revenge. And we'll hear more details about it tonight. I agree with you. Yeah.
I think we'll see some of the when you talk about who's he going to attack. We're going to hear some stuff about woke. We're going to hear about DEI, getting rid of that. That's where a lot of the Doge money, supposedly, you know, he'll say that's how we're saving money. We're getting rid of all this wokeness in government. And we haven't talked about oil and gas and kind of the negative actions he's taking against green energy. But he'll talk about how he's unleashing the American fossil fuel industry. He won't say fossil fuels, but. And we've, you know, finally
energy.
Dealt with the energy, American energy.
Which funny, like, guess who is our number one oil trading partner? Canada.
Right.
Sense.
And he'll put lipstick on the whole Ukraine thing and say that Europe is finally
stepping
up
forward.
To the plate.
Yeah, you're right.
And,
you called him.
We've gotten, you know, people are going to start paying their fair share into defense. So. Yeah.
All right, we have 5 minutes, and that should be more than enough time to let's talk about Andrew Cuomo.
Andrew.
So we mentioned, I think we didn't really get to the story yesterday, but Andrew Cuomo announced over the weekend that he is running for New York mayor. We knew this. We knew that he was going to run. This is something that he wasn't exactly quiet about. And so running for New York mayor, Cuomo also has a message for national Democrats, attacking the Democratic Party's leadership as he declared his candidacy to run for the nation's largest city. He clearly had a wider audience and his own ambitions in mind, which sounds very much like Andrew Cuomo, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So here we are again, that we're back at it with Andrew Cuomo.
If you forget all the bad stuff, if you forget the sexual harassment, if you forget the deceit over the nursing home death data, if you forget that, you've got the kind of guy that the Democratic Party, the kind of politician the Democratic Party could really use at this moment. Unfortunately, boy, he's coming in with so much baggage.
If you just change a couple words there, it would be about Trump.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, is that he must take great heart that America elected a felon. He hasn't even been convicted of anything. And he's just been accused. He can just say, it's just a witch. It was just a witch hunt from my own party, no less. It was just people didn't like me because I was tough. I wasn't a classic Democrat. I wasn't a classic liberal. I was a pragmatic, good, strong, pragmatic governor. People just didn't like me. Mm-hmm. And I did the right thing. I stepped down when I saw that it was hurting my state, but I'm ready to come back.
Mm. In the address, at this time when the nation is searching for its soul, divided as never before, questioning our democratic values, questioning the very role of government and the balance of power, New York must show the way forward and remind this nation of who we are.
Yeah, it's good rhetoric. He's a good speech maker. He's been playing up to different interest groups, trying to build his support. I do suspect he'll do better at coming back than Eliot Spitzer did when he tried to run for New York City public advocate or controller or something and lost miserably and his career ended. I think Cuomo has potential to get the position that his father never was able to get, mayor of New York City, much to his frustration.
And this is all, of course, as the Mayor Adams saga plays out and continues to. And the other obvious question being, who does he face? If he wins the primary, if Cuomo wins the primary, then who does he face?
It's possible that Adams may get nominated by the Republicans, too.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
And it might be against Adams. And in that kind of race, I think Cuomo might win. But so much can happen in the next couple of months,
And Cuomo has also been specifically reaching out to the black community in New York City, talking at Abyssinian. And some of the other mega larger churches and well-respected churches and institutional churches in the city. So I think he's kind of countered, the fact that Adams is African American. He's a good speaker. He is a strong speaker. I mean, he's got a lot going for him. If he can persuade New Yorkers that the New York Cityers that the things that happened at the state are just politics, Albany politics, I think he's got a great chance.
Well, we'll end it there. And tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about all of this stuff, like the State of the Union or the Joint Address. Yes.
Could I just add one thing?
Of course.
I really hope, when I say all that, I am not endorsing the guy, but I really hope if he does win that he has learned the lessons he should have learned as governor. That I hope he takes everything that happened as governor, everything that led to his being booted out. I hope he's had some time to think about all that. I hope you've learned. You've had some time to think about what you've done. But if he's learned his lesson, you know, maybe there's redemption here. I don't know. Okay.
Hope springs eternal.
Yeah, it hope does. Springs eternal. That's, I don't know how to respond
most,
to
that's
that.
That's the most optimistic you'll ever see me.
He's J. Jack Nowitz, Malia DeMond, and Mike Spain. Thank you all for being here. You're wonderful, and I appreciate your time and thoughtfulness. We will continue after this short break.